Hi everyone, sorry we're starting a little bit late. I was detained on the D train for about an hour this morning, but I'm really excited to talk to, we have a great panel talking about the performance, recent performance of some of the financial lenders on deck, Lending Club report in the past 2 weeks. We'll touch on the performance of the actual securities and loans that these companies have been issuing in the past few quarters and get an update on that, and also touch on some of the regulatory developments. So it'll be a pretty packed panel, and we'll do questions at the end, like Vanessa said, so please get those ready. So Ram, I want to start with you.
Sure.
You know, yesterday we saw OnDeck's earnings. A few days ago we saw Lending Club's. We're now a year removed from the May 9th event, as Lending Club likes to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, where are we, just in terms of the P&L of the companies, in terms of the origination volume, you know, where are we today versus where we were a year ago?
Sure. Let me summarize what we've seen in terms of the company news and the themes, and talk about OnDeck and Lending Club and the origination volumes. So in general, what we've seen is a pattern of higher loan loss provisions impacting non-bank lenders. We've also seen non-bank lenders focus more on developing the relationship with their borrowers by deepening their product offering. We're seeing increased emphasis on lowering financing costs and increasing different modes of distribution. Of course, securitization and other channels are part of that. The other prevailing theme we're seeing here is this dramatic turnaround in investor sentiment. So there's an article in the journal, Peter, as well, that was called OnDeck Goes from Hot Tech Startup to Dell Lender. You know, we think it's certainly a bit overstated. So
I did not write that headline or that article.
With respect to OnDeck in particular, they announced in the earnings call that they're shifting from growth to achieving profitability. They've also announced that they're lowering the distribution from the marketplace lending channel, where they sell whole loans, down to about 5% as their guidance in 2017, down from 34%. The consequence of that is that you have to build a loan loss provision, and that'll change the P&L dynamics, and we think investors are still trying to grapple and better understand how to value OnDeck stock as it goes through that transition. The stock is now valued at, you know, roughly 1.2 price to book, which is extraordinarily cheap if you consider the value of the loans and the technology and the credit score that they've developed. They started to take some actions in recent periods. They brought on Jim Rosenthal, who's the former CEO of Morgan Stanley. My speculation at this point is that if you're on deck, you're investing in the board and management team and contemplating other sources of financing, potentially securing a bank charter or acquiring a small community bank, which would generate tens of millions of dollars of impact to the bottom line. That's just my speculation. They also re-upped their credit facility with Credit Suisse, which indicates they are focused on expanding their financing capabilities. From the Lending Club perspective, they also released earnings. They beat on their guidance. However, the stock was lower primarily on higher expenses and slower growth. So part of the challenge is, if you're not growing fast enough, you can get punished from the markets. If you focus on profitability and change your story, you can get punished in the markets as well. They've also invested heavily in augmenting their board and management team. They brought on Tim Mayopoulos from Fannie Mae. I think this fits well in terms of the broader OCC charter, which I'm sure that we'll talk about later on. And then in terms of other platforms out there, SoFi continues to grow and deepen their product offering and execute successfully their ABS program. They really emerged, we think, as a funding model example for other peers in the category.
And I was remiss in introducing Ram, but I'm sure you all know who he is, CEO of PeerIQ, and our host this morning. I want to next turn to Chengyuan Liu. For those who don't know, Liu is at Victory Park, which does both venture-type equity investments in online lenders, as well as providing them balance sheet commitments so they can, you know, start extending credit and not have to tap the securitization markets right when they start. So Ram touched a little bit on how the public companies are faring. You know, as from your perspective, both as an equity investor and a debt investor in some of these companies, you know, how has investor sentiment changed, call it, in the past 6 months, maybe 12 months?
I mean, from our perspective, I think the market is still very attractive. You know, I think the VC activity has come back pretty dramatically over the last year, and partly due to, you know, valuation has been much more realistic. You know, I think you're going through sort of 2014, Lending Club OnDeck went public. You know, it sort of suppressed the private market a bit just because the valuation was so high. But you know, as the public market stock trading down, what we have seen, which is, you know, VC activity has gone up pretty dramatically. And I think also sort of the FinTech 2.0 type of newer company that's coming to the market there are a lot less Me Too type of companies that's being built. Much more, you know, the newer companies much more focused on profitability and customer acquisition and whether you're actually building something that's proprietary. I think the journal article headline was interesting. You know, I think part of the market dynamics is sort of, you know, what you're seeing is sort of this venture-backed company that would, you know, that happens to be in the specialty finance space that would grow at all cost. And look, you know, most venture-backed tech company would grow at any cost and acquire customers, but in a lending business, you know, growth really shouldn't be measured by, you know, how much dollar you're putting out. You know, ultimately, if you keep the loans, you are much more close to specialty finance company. So, like, you know, I think I sort of look at, you know, the new phenomena of every single company that's much more focused on profitability and then sort of grow responsibly and take the growth when there's, where from a unit economics point of view, you are actually making money, you're actually profitable, you're actually pricing volatility. Over the long run is actually a good thing for the industry in total. I mean, you know, Victory Park as a lender, I mean, we're very, very focused on, like, you can't lend against bad assets. You know, the structure doesn't protect you against that. So ultimately, we're very focused on the profitability of the company. We're very focused on whether the company's doing something that's unique from a credit perspective as well as from customer acquisition perspective. Are you really building something that's proprietary and scalable? So, you know, I think over the last couple of years, the trials and tribulations and the negative news that's flown through the fintech space, you know, I think in the long run, actually, you will look back and see that being a good thing for the industry, and it's just part of the maturation the industry is going through.
I'm going to ask in a little bit about maybe different verticals, consumer versus small business. But first, I want to ask William Black, who's joining us from Moody's, which has rated a number of the deals in the marketplace lending world, to touch briefly on kind of the credit outlook. I guess we'll talk about credit a little more deeply in terms of different, you know, verticals as well. But just maybe an overview how some of the securitizations have performed in recent months, the vintages versus what we saw, you know, in 2015 and 2016.
Sure. So again, my perspective on this market might be a little different from others. I'm looking at this from strictly from a credit perspective, in particular the securitizations credit. And Peter, your question is a good one. Just to take a step back, last year, almost a year ago, in fact, a little more than a year ago, we had some concerns about some of the Prosper collateral-backed transactions that we rated in terms of the performance. We did put some of those sub-bonds under review as a consequence of that concern. Subsequently, we confirmed the rating, so it ended up not crossing the threshold causing a downgrade, largely due to some of the structural element features of these transactions. They pay down very, very quickly. They deleverage very quickly in many cases. The other thing that happened last year that affected originations was, of course, the Lending Club incident where their CEO left unexpectedly. Casting a pall over much of the industry, and you saw that reflected in origination volume, which peaked in the fourth quarter of 2015 at about $3.5 billion, and fell off precipitously after that incident, and has been more or less stabilized at just over half that volume. Last count, probably Rom has better volume figures than I have at this point, but it's been coming back, but hasn't yet achieved that fourth quarter peak by the numbers that I have. In terms of performance, again, I'm not speaking to any particular issue, but the issuer, but the industry by and large. And here again, I'm going to focus on consumer installment portion of the marketplace lending market, which is the largest, but I would differentiate that from the student loan marketplace lenders, which has a very different experience, very different performance profile, very different average kind of credit quality customer by and large. The consumer installment loan performance has, we've seen, deteriorated incrementally on vintages on a year-over-year basis. And we see continue to see the two main products there are the 36-month and 60-month products. These are, you know, pretty straightforward, plain vanilla consumer credit products. But we do see quite a big distinction in performance between those two products, just as they differentiate themselves by term alone.
Just to elaborate a little bit more there, so we've seen a PRIQ, we've seen a 59% year-over-year growth in ABS issuance on a year-over-year basis. And so we've seen a mix shift from whole loan sales to ABS and warehouse finance. We expect to see substantially more volumes, particularly since ABS financing costs are substantially lower than warehouse finance costs, which remain elevated. We are seeing an uptick in delinquencies. I think it's important to look at that from the perspective of the fact that we just exited the most benign period of credit in the wake of the Great Recession. So you've had borrowers that defended their credit have performed very well. Now, as the DROGs fall off the borrower's credit profile, the total addressable population of borrowers expands. And so it's hard to distinguish a FICO 700 customer today from a FICO 700 customer 2 years ago that defended their credit through the crisis. And so we think that that is part of this renormalization of credit performance theme. The other driver of increased delinquencies is this phenomena of stacking, whereby a borrower will take out a loan from or apply for a loan from multiple different originators, and the data is not updated at the credit bureaus sufficiently fast enough to underwrite against DTI accurately. There are different technologies that are being employed to address that now. TransUnion introduced something called the Fraud Prevention Exchange, whereby there's a real-time data sharing amongst various originators to protect lenders. In general, investors are still making money, which I think is another key point. The net interest margin is going to be lower than it has been in previous years. They are buying loans, they're financing them, they're securitizing them. And the relative value of the asset as compared to other asset classes like high yield, which is now pricing between 2 to 3%, is still attractive. Also in the ABS market, the structure of the securitizations is protecting senior and mezzanine investors, and those investors have done very well.
Yeah, and I think you raised made a good observation. I'll just underscore that, and that is despite the fact that originations have fallen off, as I described, ABS issuance volume has improved, has increased. ABS continues to be an attractive source of financing for these companies. There are various reasons for that. We've seen, you know, some issuers more active than others, particularly in the student loan space. But by and large, the tenets of securitization, the characteristics or the requirements that companies need to have in order to securitize, meaning the operational belts and suspenders, the legal construct that protect investors, all of those continue to be attractive or attract investors and have to date allowed for that source of capital, source of financing to grow.
I want to ask Greg to, as if we're discussing different ways to fund the operations, either through whole loan sales or through ABS, to kind of walk us through maybe some of the legal issues that have cropped up in recent years. You know, we've had, you know, everything from the Madden Midland case kind of calling into question whole loan sales to non-bank lenders to, you know, some of the more recent moves from the OCC trying to give some of these companies a charter to lend maybe a little easier across state lines. So, Greg, maybe just kind of walk us through where we are on how the regulatory world treats these securities.
Well, you just put the rabbit in the hat, how the regulatory world treats these securities. Hi, everybody. It's a great time to be a regulatory lawyer, especially in this space, because as we all say, if everything were black and white, you wouldn't need us. But if it's gray and uncertain, that's what everybody wants the comfort that their lawyers can provide. And we do have a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace, probably starting with the one issue that we addressed there, which is, are these things securities? Well, certainly the fractionalized loans that the big issuers have already registered as securities, there's no question there, the fractionalized loans are securities. There are some ancient and hoary cases under the 33 Act that suggest that whole loans traded between banks are not securities. But there's a lot of you know, caveats there. The most important one is these are whole loans traded among banks. And then if you look at the precedents that are out there, the question of whether or not a whole loan is a security, you don't even have to get there. You have to say, what's the reasonable expectation of the investor? Would the investor looking at that piece of paper and that transaction think that he has the protection of the federal securities laws? So is it an investment contract? And I think the SEC would tell you, yes, it is an investment contract, and therefore you have to treat these as if they were securities. But that's sort of the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, whether or not it's a security just tells you you may need an exception for issuance, you may need to be under Reg D, you may need to file something. Are you going to file a registration statement? No, because you're not making a public offering, generally, of these instruments if they're whole loans. You're placing those privately. And the securities laws have a panoply of exceptions available. So I think in that regard, it's as unsettled as it ever was. We don't have any bright lights. We don't have anything suggesting one way or the other. We do have some recent closed-end funds that were formed where the SEC did require the managers to make the representation that the instruments were, in fact, securities. But think about that. A closed-end registered fund wants to be a conduit for tax purposes. The only way it can be a conduit is if it complies with subchapter M of the Internal Revenue Code, which is the same rule applicable to mutual funds. Subchapter M has a qualification requirement, which means that 90% of your income must be from securities. So if these instruments weren't securities, your entire disclosure in the registered fund space is bad because you can't get the tax treatment that you want, which is namely a conduit. So if you're going to go down the road of talking to individuals, retail, or even a greater securitization model, in order to get there, you're going to have to probably concede the point and treat these as if they were investment contracts subject to regulation. But that's sort of one piece of it. I sort of look at the regulatory morass like a Lucite cube. You know, work with me a little bit. On one quadrant, you've got the feds. Then you have the Fed regulators like the OCC. Another quadrant, you have the states. And then you have people like Moody's and others who attempt to regulate this industry. Don't forget FINRA too, because they have a horse in this race as well. So we have a bright light. The OCC comes out with its proposal for the FinTech Charter. And then as time goes on, they start refining that proposal. They say that if you're going to get an OCC charter for these FinTech banks, you need to comply with CRA rules. Well, anyone who is familiar with banks knows that the Community Reinvestment Act was designed because banks couldn't make money in underserved areas. It was too expensive for them. So if the OCC charter that they've just proposed is going to require you to, you know, comply with the CRA requirements, it may add an expense that makes the whole process untenable. So that is a big consideration. There may be some people who still proceed and get their OCC charters. But will it be the panacea? Probably not. Then you have the state's attorney general arguing that they exceeded their authority. They didn't have the ability to grant this exception from bank regulation because, you know, the OCC is very fond of talking out of both sides of its mouth and being inconsistent in what it determines to be banking activities versus non-banking activities. And it's the position of the litigation that the OCC exceeded its authority because these activities are non-bank activities, and therefore they really need to go back to Congress. Well, we see how Congress is working right now, and do we really think that something as obscure and with a very small impact and footprint like this industry is going to get the attention of Congress when they're still debating healthcare and tax reform and immigration? I don't know. Probably not, at least not in the next 100 days, and certainly not enough to make somebody's year this year. And then, of course, we have all the other regulatory actions that are out there, which I'm sure we'll get to as we go on in the program.
Yeah, I want to ask the other panelists kind of about regulation in a minute, but first I want to come back to something Ram was just citing on the delinquency and credit, you know, trends we're seeing in some of the pools here. You know, Ram, yesterday we've had OnDeck come out and say that they are changing their underwriting criteria, going, you know, shorter in duration, smaller in loan amount, trying to, you know, to really bring performance up to where it was previously. LendingClub has had several changes over the past year, most recently last week. You know, are these changes in credit policies having an effect on the pools yet? Or will we see more in the future? You know, where do you think we'll go from here?
They are having an impact. I mean, if you tighten the credit criteria, you're going to have greater performance. However, it takes time to rebuild credibility with investors. They need to see the vintage performance manifest, and that can take 6 to 18 months. At the same time, you also have increased competition, stacking concerns, which to some extent offset that. That's a challenge. You know, more generally from a credit perspective, we have an unusual scenario, right? Unemployment is at a 10-year low. Wage growth is increasing. The Fed is in a rising rate environment, which is a sign of a firming economic picture. So economic conditions are good. And then credit performance, it's a tale of two cities. So you have the mass affluent credit card issuers. So for example, American Express, JP Morgan, Citibank, that have multi-decade lows in credit card charge-off performance. We look at their public master trust data. However, if you look at the non-bank lenders which report publicly, you see double-digit increases in the loan loss provisions. So for example, Synchrony has a 45% increase in the provision year over year, Capital One 33%, OnDeck up 82%. And I think this tells you a little bit more about the, you know, economic picture across the U.S. There are population of borrowers that are more constrained in terms of access to credit, where small changes in rates and cash flows can tip that borrower into a non-performing loan. And I think that obviously has played out in the political, you know, picture with the more recent election. The other question that investors are asking in terms of credit performance is payment priority. You're seeing this play out in the auto market, and various marketplace lenders are launching these auto products. Auto in 2008, as we know, really became senior in the payment priority structure of a borrower, displacing mortgages, because mortgages, you had borrowers with negative home equity that turned in the keys. We believe that auto losses this year will exceed losses in 2008 during the Great Recession. Well, why is that? Well, the reason why that's happening is because with the emergence of new technology, including, you know, Uber and Lyft, you're seeing borrowers move the cell phone payment to the top of the payment priority structure and shift their financial obligation. So as a result, you're seeing non-bank lenders and the banks focus on establishing a central relationship with a borrower. That's why you're seeing SoFi, for example, introduce community and other types of concepts. LendingClub is deepening their relationship with their borrowers through various apps and product expansion. OnDeck is introducing data information services. We think they're taking the right steps. The next set of question is, you know, when this cycle concludes, who are the players that are going to be able to benefit from the greenfield opportunities ahead of them and less competition?
So a couple of points on, just to pick up the thread there. In general, consumer health, it's very tempting, I think, to look at, as the industry does, as we do oftentimes, and cite the exceptional credit card master trust performance as some proxy or barometer of how general consumer credit is going. It's certainly been a pretty good barometer for a fairly extended period of time, but I would argue that it's no longer a good barometer. The receivables in the trust today have been cordoned off from the rest of the, they're very well seasoned obligors. The poorer performing have long since charged off post-crisis. We keep seeing year-over-year improvement in performance. It's just more of an exception than a rule or representation of the general credit environment out there. And I think, Ram, as you alluded to, the managed book, the securitized and unsecuritized portions of the portfolios by the big banks, paint a slightly different picture, that things are not quite as good as the securitized receivables would have you believe. We're seeing some deterioration in auto lending as well, in both prime and subprime, as a consequence of years of loosening underwriting standards up until really late last year. We saw a little bit of tightening by some of the auto lenders. But again, as was alluded to earlier, that's going to take a little while. Some of that tightening that I referenced is going to take a little while to start to manifest itself in the performance. So we would expect some of the marginal deterioration, again, very incremental, to continue in the near term. And I guess the interesting aspect of that is we're in, again, one of the most benign credit environments we've been in for a very long time, and yet we're seeing some of this deterioration. So that's one point I wanted to make. The other point I wanted to make was on the issue of priority that you brought up, Peter. You know, this often gets lost in conversations about marketplace lending, but I always try to make a point of calling this out, and that a lot of marketplace lending product is built around the consumer installment loan, which is, and very people are very quick to draw comparisons to the credit card product, and I would certainly argue that they're very different products, and they're performing again well today, as virtually every credit product is performing on a relative basis well today. But when the economy turns and times get rough, the priority of payments are going to start to show in the performance. And installment loans, because the utility of those loans is gone on day one, are likely to perform far worse than credit products for which there still remains utility, call it an auto loan, even a credit card loan, or certainly a mortgage loan where you have equity in the house. All of those would be a check that you're going to write before you write something for an installment loan that's lost its utility if you have to make that choice, which is what we're talking about, right?
So is anyone seeing rewards-based programs or anything like that as a means to try to rebalance, my colleague here just said? When you think about it, one of the issues that you have, the installment loan loses its utility on day one. But if you had a reward like a lower interest rate or, who knows, gift cards to your local restaurant, whatever it might be, that reward you for paying on time goes on, is that something that the industry is exploring or should explore?
Well, it sounds like I know at least some of the more subprime-focused lenders, LendUp, among others, try to incentivize borrower behavior that way. And
right. Kind of lower, I mean, it's much more of a rebuilding credit, right? Like we see that, like, you know, LendUp is in our portfolio, and basically you take people who has a very little credit profile, and you know, they have a different product for you to graduate into. So you start with an expensive product, and then over time you build credit history, even though it doesn't show up in your FICO, and you get a better product. So like if you look at LendUp's business, it's basically built sort of reverse way. Now they have their version of the prime credit that actually has a very low default risk and get much better rate. I think the other thing I want to add to what Robin Will has said, which is, you know, the other thing to focus on, which is like during the downturn, you take, you know, every securitization takes on several seller servicer risks, regardless of, you know, what securitization that you ended up doing. Not only during downturn, the collateral that's secured in the trust takes a hit. I think, you know, it's incomparable where you take a chai deal or on deck deal versus like, you know, B of A's credit card deal, right? And you know, just look at the capitalization of the originator and the servicer. I mean, there's a lot of reps and warrant risk, and there's a lot of servicing risk that you have. And it's true every securitization has a backup servicing, but you know, if you check through sort of the securitization tape, you know, how many backup servicers are out there, and if the industry does blow up, I don't think the backup servicers are actually built to actually, you know, take on all these exposures and service these portfolios well. So I think, from a lender perspective, you sort of have to have a strategy in terms of what happens in a downturn. What would you do to the portfolio? Would you have a backup plan on top of a backup plan to take over servicing if your backup servicer couldn't really step in? How much rep and warrant exposure that you actually take to the originator, and whether they're good for it?
Yeah, we hear the same concern from various investors as well. You're likely to see more activation of the backup servicing across multiple lenders at the same time, which is when the credit cycle turns. And so you need backup servicing that can scale up quickly. Now, consider also that these lenders have different policies and also data standards around grace period and late fees. And these lenders also have not lived through a cycle and may not have the same kind of triaging capabilities that a large bank does. So I think it is an issue. It's also an identified issue as well. So there are platforms and investors are taking steps to invest in that capability.
So I agree, operational risk is, you know, that's something that we focus on when we rate a transaction. And at least all the transactions that we rated in this space to date have been structured with backup servicing arrangements. And none of them have had to call on those backup servicing arrangements to date. But that's the kind of, that's an example of the kind of belts and suspenders that comes with securitization technology, at least for this, the cohort of issuers that we're talking about to date. I would point out a couple of things. A, you know, it's true that we don't know because we haven't had a live case, at least in the rated world, our rated world, of a transfer of servicing. But transfers of servicing do and have occurred. Mm-hmm. And they sometimes go really, really well, and sometimes they don't go really well, is the truth. But the if you have the plumbing in place to transfer the servicing, and particularly for marketplace lenders where the vast majority of payments are done through ACH, you're standing in passive receipt of payments coming in or debiting a checking account. So the lift, you know, dialing for dollars or however you want to refer to a classic collection duties is lighter, at least from that perspective, than maybe a traditional portfolio takeover. So that's one thing. The other thing that I would say is if something were to happen to the marketplace lending industry, and as you posit, it transfers would be happening by multiple lenders at once, I would still argue that the eligible backup servicers and trustees who would be called upon or may be called upon to take over those servicing duties is capable of taking on that scale. We're still talking about, in the scheme of collecting consumer credit, consumer debt, this is a tiny, tiny portion of consumer credit out there. So I think the scale part of this, again, I'm not saying there wouldn't be rough patches and transferring over anything during a time of duress, which is almost by definition what would be, that would be the context of such a transfer, but the scale of the assets that we're talking about here is still quite small in the scheme of things.
Greg, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think a very important observation, when things start to go south, they go south very quickly, and the idea that a originator will be able to act as a debtor in possession in bankruptcy with its same expense structure and bring in a backup servicer, again, at an additional expense, and protect the assets to the investor group, it's not happening. I mean, basically what you need to do if you're the investor is aggressively remove that management team and put it into a Chapter 7 liquidation, preserve the assets as much as possible, and that means you have to cut expenses to the bone. And that means you don't need a prime backup servicer. You need someone who knows how to get down in the trenches and actually collect these things on a subprime basis. And unfortunately, I know for some of you this probably sounds anathema, but when you're dealing with the bankruptcy code and you're dealing with these credits, unfortunately, you have to be tough as nails, and you cannot be Mr. Nice Guy or Mr. Nice Lady, because you're protecting your money at that point. And the guy who got you into that problem, the originator, what makes you think they have the talent to get you out of that problem? The answer is probably they don't. So you know, if you're holding this paper, you have two choices. You either write it or you sell it. But if you sell it, you're selling it for fractions of the dollar. If you decide that you're going to write it, well, that means you need to take control of the process, and that means you probably need a very aggressive approach in the bankruptcy courts in order to protect your asset value.
And I think, you know, that's a good point. And I think when we, because this industry is still, you know, quite new, I know some have been around for years now, but still, you know, haven't been through a true credit cycle and everything. We assume when we rate a transaction that the originator, or call them the platform, have gone bankrupt on day one. That's an assumption that we make when we rate, because the ratings being asked for on the assets are much higher than what would be if the originator or the platform were rated. So that's our starting analytical point for our approach to rating the assets that are backed by these, is that the originator is gone on day one. So now you are relying on the technology of securitization to transfer, to ensure that the backup servicer has the legal and the operational ability to take over those assets and collect on them. And we believe that in those arrangements that we, again, the deals that we've rated to date, that the backup arranger is capable of doing that.
Well, we've primarily been talking about, you know, unsecured consumer installment credit. Are we seeing any discrepancies in performance, in yield, in you know, in small business, in maybe secured consumer, and in any other kind of online lending world beyond just the most popular consumer unsecured space?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you're talking about commercial debt to someone involved in the consumer space, that becomes essentially consumer debt. And we're seeing investors looking at those investments as if they were buying the underlying loans, assuming, as Will said, a bankruptcy, and we're in that Armageddon posture. Other consumer debt, you know, fin debt is, or tech debt rather, is what is, you know, and that's a very big mega cycle that is boom and bust. Right now it's sort of boom. And then small manufacturing, you know, that's doing well because the economy is doing well. Retail's terrible.
So I would just, you know, I think I made the point before, we're seeing a distinction between unsecured consumer installment loan performance and, say, student loan performance, okay? Why is that? A number of reasons, but probably the main reason is that the lenders in the student loan space, we call them refi lenders, refinancing student loan, student lenders in the marketplace space, I'll use marketplace loosely here, we're talking about SoFi, we're talking about DRB, we're talking about Common Bond. They're targeting an extremely super prime borrower, someone who has gotten a job, by and large, has a proven track record of repayment, usually very high FICOs, et cetera. And the losses and delinquency experience for those pools have been, you know, as you would expect, quite low. And that's reflected in performance, it's reflected in our expectations, and reflected to a large degree in the ratings and the structures. Relative to the unsecured consumer installment loans, where generally you're targeting a much broader swath of the consumer quality spectrum. So again, we're seeing distinctions there, much higher ELs relative to the student loan space. You asked about small business. We don't rate any of the marketplace lenders, small business platforms, but small business, we have rated small business portfolios in the past. That, again, you have to be careful of how you define that space. There are small businesses, and then there are big small businesses. You know, there's the sole proprietorships out there that you know, we've seen that tend to be pro-cyclical, call it. They tend to do really poorly in bad economies, and they tend to do really well in good economies. And that I would say is, you know, an area where there is, by that definition anyway, amplified risk as a consequence of being pro-cyclical.
I mean, it's interesting, right? It's a double-edged sword for small business, right? It's investors like them because it provides. It's very hard to get exposure to small businesses. You know, consumer loans, you sort of can, you know, there's so many originators that does that. So people like the diversification factor to it. But, you know, to Will's point, like, small business is just such a vast space. They're not really created equally. The data sets are very non-uniform. So it's very hard to underwrite small business as a segment with a broad brush. So I think what you have seen in the small business space, whether it's MCA, whether it's small business loans, is, you know, I think all the originator has tried to push the boundaries in terms of, you know, who they can make loans to and what credit risk is perceived to be priced correctly. And I think over the last few years, what you have seen is just through that pushing of boundaries, there's a lot of volatility in the space. I think, you know, having been on the originator side, I think it's a vastly underserved market. So I think you need to walk a very fine line in terms of be afraid of the risk that you're taking on, and but at the same time not be too afraid, then you're not innovating anymore, and then you become banks and you're not really expanding the customer base. You know, don't forget why you started a company. So I think it's a fine line, and it's, you know, it's easier for you to take that risk when you're a private company than when you're a public company. So obviously you're seeing that play out in the public forum, in certain sectors. I think taking healthy amount of risks to expand the universe that you can serve is ultimately a good thing, because otherwise we're not innovating, and that's, you know, I think ultimately that's the exciting part about the fintech space, is you are expanding the people that you otherwise wouldn't have served.
Yeah, just to elaborate on that, I think that's a good positive coda to conclude here. I mean, clearly 2 years ago there was a lot of hype around fintech lending. Now the pendulum has swung the exact opposite way, and we have these titles in the newspaper. Are these companies any different than banks? And the answer is yes, they are. There is genuine innovation here. If you look at the number one mortgage originator in the US, it's no longer a bank, it's called Quicken. If you look at the auto industry and the personal lending industry, these are dominated by non-banks, and these non-banks are using technology to incorporate underwriting data in a novel way, or to acquire borrowers in a novel way, or deliver a customer experience that banks cannot deliver. And that is improving access to credit and financial inclusion and lowering the cost of borrowing. And this is a legitimate transformation. BlackRock, via their Chai platform, is now funding loans to retail investors on Main Street. This is really the same kind of transformation that you saw take place with the mortgage market, where you've had mortgages move from bank origination and bank funding through your local community bank to mortgages being funded by the debt capital markets and ABS investors. And that phenomena is playing out in all the other consumer credit asset classes, and technology and innovation is an important part of that.
Okay, well, we're 5 minutes past time, so I apologize for that. I know we crammed a lot in, but I hope you guys all enjoyed the discussion, and I want to thank the panelists for joining me today.